Good evening. Thank you very much for braving Hurricane Sandy. Now I think I heard on the radio it's officially Tropical Storm Sandy. So let's make sure we address her appropriately. The topic for tonight is determining capacity for consent or patient capacity for consent. My standard disclaimer applies when I'm dealing with a matter of halacha, a matter of Jewish law, that for practical questions you should consult the rabbi of your synagogue. I'm just discussing issues which come up, but practical questions really should be dealt with by the community central authority, whoever that is for a particular community. I see Jeff just made it here, which is good, and not just because it's good to have Jeff here, although that's true, but also because Jeff has the all-important sign-in sheets. For those who are taking this for CME credit, you need to make sure to sign in. Also, the evaluation forms that follow actually have been somewhat changed this year. University of Toronto requests that everybody fill out an evaluation. Even if you're not taking it for credit, they would like to have everybody fill out an evaluation. And to that end, we're putting the evaluation online. So after the class, you should get an email with a form, with a link, and then you'll be able to just click on the link, fill out the form, and it's that straightforward. And I thank Albert Kirshen for taking care of that end of things. Rather than use vignettes for this session, I thought it would be more helpful to actually use one-line questions, the ones that you see on your sheet right below the educational objectives. The objectives are the standard ones that we used last year in terms of what we want to accomplish. You can reread it there. But the questions that we ask are listed there. Three questions. Number one, under Jewish law, does a physician require a patient's informed consent? Or should the physician say, I am healing you. Whatever I believe is necessary, and it's going to be better than the patient's medical advice in any case. And so therefore, I don't need the consent of the patient. That's question number one, is do we even recognize a need for consent? Number two, does Jewish law provide a practical definition of incapacity? If we're going to say, and we will say, in fact, that in certain cases consent is required, is there a standard for ability to provide consent? We can certainly think of obvious cases in which a patient cannot consent. You have a patient who's in a persistent vegetative state. What are you going to do? Then that's going to lead to our third question, actually. But first, what is the standard for capacity to provide consent? And then the third question, who speaks for an incapacitated patient and using what standard? How do they make their decisions? So I'm hoping to reach all of this tonight and to do all of that before the winds get really bad. Apparently what's outside now is actually not really bad. Really bad is supposed to be between 10 p.m. and 3 a.m. tonight, according to 680. So we'll try to get everybody home before then. Just to reiterate for those who just came in, please do sign in, especially if you're taking this for CME credit. But also we require that evaluations be filled out. And to that end, we are going to email you a link for an online evaluation. This is required as part of the credit process through the University of Toronto. So even if you're not taking this as a credit class, you're just here to learn Torah or to learn more about medicine, either way, please do fill out that evaluation when the email comes. Okay. As a side note in all of this, but I think it's an interesting point, the question that we're addressing tonight is not really a medical question at all. It's not about evaluating whether someone's in a life and death circumstance. It's not about evaluating what's the best course of treatment for a patient. What it's really about is a law in the area of Judaism that we identify as nizikin, damages, torts, for those who are in the legal field. Because the question fundamentally is, when can a person consent, and how does a person consent to allow somebody else to do something to him, which may be harmful? In other words, somebody comes up to me and says, Toshiner, I would like permission to slap you in the face. So, am I, number one, does he require my consent? The answer, Yes. But the number one, does he require my consent? Number two, how do you gauge whether I'm able to provide consent to that assault? And number three, if I can provide consent, but somebody else says, actually, Torchina would prefer X, by what standard do they make these decisions? How do they have the authority to make that decision? So those are the questions that we need to address. It's not really a medical question. It's really a question of damages that one party might inflict on another and what the legal rights are. So under secular standards, consent is understood today. It was not always so. But patient consent is understood today to be a moral and legal requirement. It's taken as a given in a world in which life is the property of the individual and medical judgment is recognized as potentially flawed, since the doctor is no longer considered to know everything, and since it's my body, my choice, therefore, you can't just assume that you can do to me whatever you think is appropriate. The patient has to be given information which is task-specific. This is, again, under secular law. It can't just be that the patient says to the doctor, do whatever you want, I trust you. That doesn't qualify as consent. The patient has to know what is going to happen. So that the secular standard, as I understand it, based on my reading, is really threefold. Number one, the information given to the patient must be task-specific and complete. Number two, the process of reaching the decision must be reasoned and coherent. It doesn't matter whether it's the right decision. In the secular standard, there is no such thing as the right decision. But did the patient go through a thought process that we would recognize as being well-reasoned? And then third, the patient has to demonstrate consent for the task that's going to be performed with a decision that relates to it and that weighs the risk that is involved, so that the more risky the issue, the more complete the response must be. Question? Okay. That's the secular standard. What about within Jewish law? We start with our initial question of, is consent in fact necessary in halacha, in Jewish law? I'll ask you, based on your knowledge of Torah and Judaism, would you expect that a doctor would require consent before embarking on some treatment? No? Why not?
Mm-hmm. So it's not, I don't think it's the doctor's obligation to ask the person whether or not, if they're drowning or whatever, do you want to be saved? So they just have to do it.
Well, you're assuming a life and death case then.
Yeah.
What if it's not a life and death case? Somebody goes to the doctor and the doctor says, you know, you just cut yourself. Okay, you cut yourself on a piece of metal. I looked up your records. You haven't had a tetanus booster in however many years. I think you need a shot. The patient immediately grabs his shoulder and says, you're not giving me a shot. Absolutely not. I refuse. And the doctor says, I can see it spreading, whatever signs the doctor has to understand that tetanus is setting in. And the doctor says, I have to give you this shot. Does the doctor require consent? Well, there I'm already getting into a life and death potential case. All right, so I blew that one. But hypothetically, this could be, you know, beyond a life and death case. Does the doctor then require consent? Yeah, absolutely. There's the possibility that somebody turns around and says, you hurt me, and in fact, I'm going to sue. I'm going to bring you to court because you did X to me, this constitutes assault. Not just in the laws of in Jewish laws of damages, that's true in secular laws of damages as well. Ellen.
Well, you could argue from the word that actually Hashem has already given the doctor consent.
Right. So one argument, like the argument about saving a life, is that the Torah says that the doctor shall heal, and in fact the Talmudic comment on that is Mikan Shenitna Rishus Larofe Larapos. From here we see that the doctor has been given permission to heal. Well, once you have God's permission, why do you need a human being's permission? You would seem to be free and clear. That argument could be made. In fact, the halachic standard, the standard of Jewish law, often seems to argue that consent is irrelevant. Often, consent is meaningless because a patient is obligated to consent. Remember that within traditional Judaism, your life is not your property. And therefore, if someone is trying to save it, you don't really get a vote. And consent is irrelevant.
That's life and death.
That's life and death, correct.
So how about when he cuts himself and the doctor says, that's a bad cut, you need stitches?
Right, so now that's not a life and death case anymore. Right, true. I'm going to come back to this in a second.
How do you know it's not a life and death case? How do you know any medical injury is not ultimately a life and death case? I mean, you're making a bad decision.
Right. But let's say all the players involved make that assessment. In other words, not just the patient says, I don't need it, but the doctor says, no, you're right. You don't need this. You will survive this cut even without stitches, but there will be disfigurement or whatever.
But Mike, in fact, you know, you actually don't know the consequences of any medical act.
Right. But there's a threshold of reasonable doubt. I mean, I'm going to come back to doubt about the medical act. But in terms of whether the treatment is necessary or not, there is a threshold at which point you say, this is not a reasonable concern. I do not need to worry that I'm going to contract flu if I am outside in the rain in July. There are certain things that are just not within the normal realm of doubt. Coming to it. Good question. Hold on. There is another point just in terms of buttressing the point that the doctor doesn't always need consent. The physician may have the authority and even obligation at times, and this goes back to saving a life, to override the patient's refusal. Classic example. Someone on Yom Kippur says, I'm fine, I don't need to eat, don't worry about me. The doctor takes one look at the person and says, that person needs food. The law is, we follow the doctor. We don't listen to the patient who says, I don't need to eat. We follow the doctor who says, give that person food. So we do have cases in which we say consent is irrelevant. However, in complex cases, and many of our cases today qualify as complex, consent is required in order that it not be considered assault on the patient. The key question for the doctor is, are you reasonably certain that your treatment path is correct? Are you reasonably certain that your treatment path is correct? If it's not clear that the treatment is appropriate, then this could indeed be called, in Hebrew, chavala, in English, assault, wounding, literally. There are mixed opinions on the validity of treatment. That raises questions. If you take a look at source number one, I've brought this source in other sessions as well. Rabbi Yaakov Emdin writes, Kasav Magen Avram B'Shem Radvaz. Rabbi Yaakov Emdin was a rabbi in 18th century Germany, early 18th century Germany. And he wrote, quoting Rabbi Avram Gambiner, the Magen Avram from the 17th century, in the name of Radvaz, which puts it back in the 16th century, actually, in Spain, I believe, Shem Rofe Omer Tzarich, if a doctor says that a treatment is needed, Im lo ratza hachola lekabel hatrufa kofenoso, if the patient says, I don't want it, we compel him to take it. That's the quote. But then he says, Nir Ali, it appears to me, davka kisharotze limnoa mihishtamesh berefua havada'it, that this is particularly where the patient is refusing a definite treatment. And then in parentheses, avhastamit al yidei rofe mumcha kevada'it chashiva, even a treatment of unknown nature, where you don't know whether it will cure or will not cure, but it's prescribed by a doctor who is an expert, is considered to be like an expert known treatment. In other words, when your doctor says to you, this is the way we treat this ailment, even if he can't answer the question of, can you guarantee me that this is going to treat it? Nonetheless, if that's the normal prescription by expert doctors, that's good enough to say the patient does not have the right to refuse. That's what we say. And in such a case, That's where we say the patient cannot refuse lahachmir al atzmo mechshash isur de Shabbat. Even if he says, well, it's Shabbos and I don't want to take the medicine on Shabbos, I don't want to undergo the treatment on Shabbos, we say to him, forget it, you're getting the treatment. And yes, this is assuming a life and death circumstance. But then it continues to say, if the patient refuses it because he says, you know what, to me, this is not a tried and tested treatment. I don't necessarily think that this works. Even if it's just because he personally says, I don't believe it. You could show me as many reports and research studies as you want. I don't trust it. In that case, we will not compel him. And certainly if he has a doctor on his side. Ein kofin. We don't compel him. And certainly if he believes that this treatment is actually going to be harmful to him, the patient has the right of refusal where it is not considered a definite treatment. Now, I quoted this in an earlier session, and you may recall from the follow-up emails for those who were there, that I looked into this further because I think the question was asked when I said this at the session. Well, today you could find a doctor somewhere, you know, anywhere who's going to side with you, you know, no matter what stance you take on anything. You could take the most ridiculous stance in the world. And you'll find someone who will agree with you. That's the nature of crowdsourcing. So at that point, how can you tell me that we're going to support the patient against the physician? So I spoke to Rav Herschel Schechter about this. I asked him this question. And the response was that we don't necessarily actually follow the statement of Rav Yaakov Emden. This is not necessarily considered legally authoritative. So keep that in mind. There's another case, though. There's another type of circumstance in which we would say patient consent is required. The first case is where it's not a definite treatment, according to Rabbi Yaakov Emden, whose position is quoted by some on this issue, principally by the Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Avraham in Israel. But and there also, they have the discussion that was mentioned before about dangerous treatment now versus future pain later on, and the patient is said to have the right to say, I decline a dangerous treatment now in order to avoid pain. I'm not interested in this treatment. The second class, yeah. Right. No, I hear you. My gut, although I want to research this, and I'm just noting it down so I will remember to do so. My gut is to say yes, it has the same status as treatment does. Because in the laws of Shabbos, when we talk about what you're allowed to do on Shabbos in order to treat an ailment, we include not only direct treatment of the illness, but also all the steps that are normally done in order to diagnose the illness. So a patient comes into the hospital on Shabbos complaining of inability to breathe, and the signs are there for lung infection, you know, some kind of pneumonia. The doctors are supposed to do whatever are the routine exams in order to verify that that's what's going on, and anything they deem necessary in order to be able to initiate treatment. So investigations are given the status of medical care in there, and I would expect here too, but I want to look into it. It's a good question. Jeff. So once we'd say that we've crossed the threshold where consent is required, it then becomes a question of, so what does consent mean? And I want to get to that in the next part. So let's see. I don't know that I'll answer it adequately, so keep the question in mind, but that's where I want to go with this. But the second class of case, which may require consent from a patient, is where it's not actually, the treatment is not actually something that's going to heal the patient. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach dealt with this in the context of a patient with advanced diabetes who had already had one leg amputated, and now the second leg had developed gangrene, and the question was, do you amputate the patient's leg? The patient says no. The patient refuses. Are the doctors somehow required to go ahead with this despite the patient's refusal? And if you take a look at source number 3, you see it there from Shlomo Zalman Orbach, quoted in the Nishmas Avram. He says, "Ein levatzaya nituach kazeh neged ritzono shel hachole." You do not conduct such a surgery against the patient's wishes. O afil lenasos l'shachneya ozo laskimu nituach. Not only that, he says in the parentheses in the Hebrew, you don't even try to convince the patient to undergo the surgery. Kevin shemedubar kan benituach gadol umzukan, because you're dealing with a surgery which itself is great and dangerous in its own right, and Shirak Yosif Lesivlo Shalachola, Belisi Kwe Koshu L'chaye Olam. You're just going to increase the patient's suffering, you're extending suffering without any promise that the patient is now going to live longer. He's going to live longer than he would have if the leg stayed on. But you're not curing the underlying problem of diabetes. You're just handling the immediate infection of the leg. So this isn't a true case of healing. And therefore, you could argue what you're really doing is wounding the patient. It may extend the life a little bit, but it's extending pain too, at the same time, without really curing. So at least in these two sets of cases, number one, where the treatment is in doubt, and number two, where the treatment isn't actually going to end the patient's problem, and it's actually going to increase pain, it's going to extend a painful existence, consent is going to be required. Well, then, how do you give consent? Is there a point where we say someone is not capable of consent? So the secular model for capacity and consent, as we've discussed, is that the patient must know everything that the doctor can tell him about the task at hand, whatever it is that's going to be carried out. The patient has to have a good decision-making process, and the patient has to demonstrate that consent. Making what, in general, both in secular and in the way the Torah law is going to look at it, making what we consider to be a bad decision does not automatically disqualify you. It does not mean someone is called incapacitated. In secular ethics, it's certainly true because there you have the concept of subjectivity, and anyone can make his own decision about his own life. But it's true in Jewish law as well. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 4. Dealing with laws of inheritance, Maimonides writes, "Katan shehigdil, a child who matures, afilu haya ochel v'shosa yoser midai, even if he eats and drinks excessively, umafsid v'holech v'derech ra'a, and he destroys his property and he travels a bad path, ain based in mon in mimenu mamono, the courts cannot keep him from inheriting whatever assets he was supposed to inherit when he came of age." And they may not appoint a guardian for him. If he asks for one, that's a different story. But the fact that he's making bad decisions doesn't mean that he's not an adult. He is still an adult. He's considered to be functional. So that's an important piece to keep in mind as we go through this. We have, within classic traditional Jewish literature, 3 different models for incapacity. One is called shote, meaning irrational. One is called peti, or pesi in Ashkenazi, which means someone who has poor comprehension, doesn't understand the information. And one is called nechpaz, which means someone who is hasty, does not have a good decision-making process. So irrationality, poor understanding, and poor decision-making process. And now we're going to go through each of these 3 categories. First of all, irrationality. That's the one called a shote. That's probably the one that's most familiar to people, in part because you've probably heard the word which has made into Yiddish, shtus, which means foolishness, irrational conduct, but also because that's the term that comes up most often Talmudically in discussions about rationality is, in fact, the term shote. If you take a look at source number 5, you see the Hebrew on one side, the English creeps onto the other. I'm not sure what happened here with my PDF, but I see that the line didn't quite end up the way I wanted them to, so that's why if it spills over from one page to the next, I'll try to change it before I upload the the document. Okay. Gemara in Hagiga, source number 5. Tanu Rabbanan, the sages said, Ezehu Shota, who is a Shota? Who qualifies as irrational? Hayotze Yechidi Balayla, one who goes around alone at night. Vehalan Beves HaKevaros, someone who sleeps in the cemetery. Vamekareya Es Kesuso, somebody who tears his clothing. That's my standard. It doesn't mention someone who goes to a shear in a hurricane. So we're okay. Itmar, we learned. Rav Huna Omar, Ad Shukulan Bevas Achas. Rav Huna, one of the sages, says, Shota means he did all three of these, not just one of them. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Afilu Be'achas Me'en. Rabbi Yochanan disagrees and he says, no, any one of these behaviors is good enough for us to say this person is irrational. Now, right now, we are assuming these are specific behaviors. Nothing else is going to render the person irrational. Just these three. So, Heichi Dami, what's your case? The Gemara asks. Either Abeluhu Derech Shtus Afilu B'chadanami. Even if he does this in the manner of irrationality, meaning we can't see any sane reason why he would do these things, then even one of them warrants calling him a shota. He doesn't need to collect all three. What if he lives in a place where there are no cemeteries? He can't become a shota because he didn't, you didn't check off each one on the list. And if he does it in a manner that's not irrational, Afilu kulunami, then even if he does all of these, he's still not a shota. Let's say he goes walking alone at night because he's really angry at everybody in the house and he needs to calm down and he says, I'm going to go for a walk. That's not irrational. Frankly, that's rational. So why would you label him a shota for that? Lo, so the question is no. La olam deka avid lehu derech shtus. The answer is we're talking about somebody who does these in an irrational manner. To onlookers, it seems clear that he's not thinking straight. Kevan deavdinhu lekulu. Once he does all of them, havalehu kamisha shenagach shor chamor vegamal v'naseh muad lakol. He says we'll borrow a term from tort law, from laws of damages. If I have an animal that is not known to be dangerous, it's not of a type that's dangerous, it's called a tum. And the rule is that I am not required to anticipate that it might harm somebody and take extra measures to be sure that it doesn't harm anybody. It's not known to be dangerous. However, if it establishes a pattern of attacking, it's called mu'ad, meaning forewarned. And now I have to take special measures, and if I don't take special measures and it harms somebody, I'm going to be extra liable. So he says, a person who performs all three of these activities in a clearly irrational manner qualifies as irrational as a shota, just like an animal that attacks an ox and a donkey and a camel. We now say, across the board, this creature is dangerous. Amar of Papa. Rav Papa comments on this. Ishmiel Leila Rav Huna, he says, Rav Huna, who said, you have to do all three of these to be labeled irrational. He says, if Rav Huna had heard the following statement from an earlier generation, he would have changed his mind. The statement was, Ezehu Shota, who is a Shota, Zehama Abed Komasha Nos Nimlo, someone who destroys everything you give him. He destroys all the property he has, you give him something, he ruins it. That is a small child. No, that is a shota. That's the statement. Iboyalu, to which the Gemara asks, Ki avahadir bay, mi mekareya kasuso hu da avahadir bay, didam yaloha? Oh, da mamikulu avahadir. The Gemara says, I don't really understand Rav Papa. Do you mean to say he would have thrown out all his criteria and said this is the sole criteria? Just the sole criterion is he destroys his property? Or would he have just gotten rid of the tearing the clothing one because that's so similar? And the Gemara says, take of this is unresolved. We don't know. That's our key source for defining this category that we call a shota. There is quite a bit of debate. I brought it in source number 6, a little bit of it, regarding what you mean when you say three categories, one more category. What exactly is this about? Rabbi Yosef Karo, in source number 6, he's the author of the Shulchan Aruch, but before he's the author of the Shulchan Aruch, he's the author of Beit Yosef, which is a commentary on an early code of law called the Torah. So he brings a debate as to whether this definition is specific. Is it really, are we really going to say that you have to have these three categories? Are you going to say that it has to have the fourth category? If you take a look, I'm going to go through this a little bit quickly, just in the interests of time. But he says, he says, it appears that one of the four behaviors mentioned, the initial three, and then that of destroying his property, would make a person a shota, doing just one, but any other rational act would not render him a shota. But he says, from the language of the Rambam of Maimonides, it doesn't appear so, because Maimonides doesn't bring these. Those are not his criteria. He only says a person whose mind is torn, nitrofadaito, his mind is confused. That's it. He doesn't bring all of these different behaviors. So that the position of Rabbi Yosef Karo is that the Rambam says irrationality is not something which is limited to these four criteria that are mentioned in the Talmud, but when a person acts irrationally, that person is a shota. These were just examples. That's the way he understands the definition. We in fact do say, as Rabbi Yosef Karo says here, that a person can be rendered irrational such that, to go back to our original case, he will not be able to give consent if he acts in an irrational way. And not only that, even if he acts irrational in one particular area. Take a look, please, at source number 7. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. They're dealing there with laws of testimony, but it'll apply for us as well. Shote pasul. A shote, a person who is irrational, is disqualified. Velo shote shu holecha ruma mishaber kelim v'zare gavanim bilvad. Not just somebody who walks around without clothing on, who breaks property, who throws stones. Ela komisha nitrafa daito v'nimtzeis daito mishubeshes tamid v'davar mehadavarim. But even somebody who acts irrationally in some specific area constantly. Some aspect of conduct, some field of knowledge, whatever it is, not knowledge, but some field of interaction, he acts in an irrational way. That's it. He is already a shota. Even though he can speak and respond on point in every other area. Once we identify a point in which he is irrational, that person is disqualified from serving as a witness. He is considered a shota. He can be as sharp as you like. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote in a tshuva, in a response, if I didn't bring it here, it's Yoredeya, the fourth volume, and it's Tshuva Chavtes, number 29. He says, even if a person seems sharp in many areas, it doesn't matter. If he acts irrationally in one area, now he's considered irrational in all areas. This is, at bottom, a subjective judgment. Surprise. I mean, you didn't really expect there was going to be a written standard. It is a subjective judgment. The Chasam Sofer makes this point in source number 8. Rav Moshe Sofer, writing in Hungary in the 18th century, he says, Hine, lidon v'dine hashotem i'efshar ki'im b'ri'yas eine hadayan ha'mevin ma tivo umahuso. He says, to actually evaluate that somebody is a shota, someone is irrational, can only be done through the eyes of the judge on the scene who sees the person and understands his nature. It's impossible to clarify in writing. I'm going to give you a set of written guidelines what his nature is. He says, I can't do it. And in fact, he says, the Rambam, Maimonides, said the same. He wrote in the Laws of Testimony, "Ve'ein l'dayin ela masha'ein of roos." The judge only has what his eyes see. You can't. He says, "I can't give you written guidelines. You know it when you see it." That's the idea. And this is our first model for incapacity: is the patient who presents as irrational, even if the patient does not present as irrational on this particular subject. Even still, we already questioned, can this patient actually make that decision? Yes.
So just going back to number four, mm-hmm.
Right. Right. Right, so that's a really good question. I think it's more a flaw in my translation, and thank you for catching it, because I really should correct it. There are different words that are used in the Hebrew for destroying property. In source number four, the Rambam's terminology is umafsid. Lahafsid is more to lose, whereas the language that's used in the criteria of irrationality is me'abed, which is active destruction, like taking a hammer and smashing it. What this suggests more in source number four is somebody who is wasteful, whereas the Shota standard is more destructive. So thank you, that's a good catch. So that's our first category of incapacity. Our second category is the person of poor comprehension. Just intellectually isn't able to grasp the information that he or she is being given about the case at hand. The term that we said in Hebrew is peti. Poor comprehension means, though, that there's no understanding. It's not just a little bit. I mean, frankly, speaking as someone who's not a physician, yeah, it can be very hard to understand what the physician is saying. The physician may have limited time in the room, tries to explain it, doesn't realize that I didn't get it. It's not as though we're now going to say that all people who are confused by medical terminology are unable to give consent, because that's going to render the whole consent process meaningless. If you take a look at source number 9, we find the Rambam's wording. He says, "Hapsa'im bioter," those who are especially petty, especially foolish. She'ein makirim dvarim shesosrin ze'ez ze'. They don't recognize when two statements contradict each other. V'lo yavinu inyanei hadavar kederach shemivinim sh'ar am ha'aretz. There's your threshold. They don't understand things in the way that other standard normal people do. Not doctors, but the way that normal people will comprehend. That's our standard. And then he continues with the rest of the line, but I want to come back to that. The rest of the line, don't pretend it's not there. We're talking about somebody who doesn't really understand. This comes up in source number 10 as well, by Yosef Trani, dealing with the ritual of chalitza. If a man passes away without having a child, so his wife is now able to marry his brother. That's the practice called yibum. In English, it's called levirate marriage. I don't know what that means in real English, but the idea is that she can marry him and be taken into the family, or either at his initiative or at her initiative, they can split up with what's called chalitza, a separate ritual for which there is no English analog. So this chalitza ritual requires some understanding of what you're doing. What happens if the brother is this person, the peti, the person who doesn't comprehend? So source number 10, Rabbi Yosef Trani wrote in the 16th century, I wrote Israel/Turkey because he moved. Hecha shemaz brulei v'savar. If they explain it to him, and he understands, shebachalitza zun ifteres mimenu, that with this act of chalitza, she will be freed from him, ein sarach sheyiya bebinas libo ba'osa shah, he does not need to understand at that moment, ela afal pisha b'sh'as chalitza hisiach daito, even if he loses his concentration at that point, he forgets, he suddenly doesn't understand the way that chalitza works, he's thinking of something else. Shop your dummy, it's fine. Now, the truth of the matter is that as I'm reciting this source, I'm sort of thinking that this isn't quite the poor comprehension person. Right? This is a person who is easily distracted and forgetful. So I'm not quite comfortable lumping this person into the same category as the peti that we said before. I wonder about this case. I'm just trying to qualify that a little bit. But it's clear, and Ramosha Feinstein says this as well, that peti as a category is someone who is perfectly rational, but intellectually doesn't necessarily grasp what's going on. Now, one of the key.
Diabetic kiosk diagnosis and they're very confused. They don't know the date, they don't
there is such a thing as being temporary shavta. When the Rambam, we quoted him earlier, when the Rambam said, "Vidavar echad me hadvarim." Oh no, so it was a Shulchan Aruch. In source number 7, it said that he is constantly confused. In the event that a person goes through a period of time in which he displays irrationality, but then that ends, and particularly where we can explain why there was an infection, there was whatever, that's generated the irrationality, and now that condition is no longer present, then the shota status does in fact end.
But while they're in that state.
They are a shota. Yes. So, in terms of this person who is the peti, the person who has poor comprehension, we do not extrapolate. Whereas with the shota, we extrapolated and said, irrational in one area is irrational everywhere. When it comes to poor comprehension, that's not true. If you take a look on the sheet at source number 11, Rabbi Yoshua Falk, and that's, if you see at the bottom there, sorry about that, I'm going to correct that on the file. But the source number 11, you see where it ends and number 12 begins. Rabbi Yoshua Falk, writing in his Sma, Sefer Me'irat Einayim, commentary to the section of the Code of Jewish Law called Choshen Mishpat, he says, Zeu achiluk bein pesi l'shote. He says, this is the difference between pesi, the person who doesn't comprehend, and shote, the person who is irrational. Shashote daito hi mishubeshes umiturefes legamri bedavar mehadavarim. The shota's mind is confused and torn in some particular matter, and therefore we call him a shota in everything. Masha einkein, which is not so, peti she'enu mitaref legamri b'shum davar. The peti is not entirely torn in one matter; he's torn in everything. He doesn't. He's not torn. He's not irrational. But his problem is really across the. I'm sorry. The peti is where he lacks understanding in the area at hand. That's how to phrase it. He lacks understanding in the area at hand. And this is brought as halacha by the Chasam Sofer and Evan Ha'ezer, volume 2, number 2, that sits Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg as well. The disqualification is somewhat limited, but I'm going to actually skip that point because it's not relevant directly for our discussion. It's worth noting that there are areas of Jewish law in which he may actually be able to function like everybody else. Again, though, the rule that we presented before from the Chasam Sofer applies here as well. This is subjective. It has to be evaluated by the person on the spot. You can't give a written test. This qualifies as peti, this does not qualify as peti. It really has to be evaluated on scene. But that's my second category. So that brings me to the third category. The third category of the three is the person who has a poor decision-making process, what we called before in Hebrew, nechpaz. If you remember when the Jews are in Egypt, and they're going to leave Egypt, and they're told to eat the Karban Pesach, the Pesach offering, they're told to conduct that first Seder, v'chipazon. In haste. Nechpaz is a person who is gripped by haste. Go back now, please, to that source number 9, that Rambam, in the second half of what Maimonides had to say. In the Hebrew, it's the end of the first line of Maimonides. In the English, it's towards the beginning of the second line, where it says also. V'chein, ha-mevo halim v'anechpazim b'da'atam, v'mishtag'im b'yoter. He says, those who are confused and hasty in their minds, and those who are especially foolish, harei elu b'chlal ha-shotim, these are in that category of shota. It's not because they're irrational, it's because they're hasty. They don't have a trusted decision-making process. He says, this has to be based on what the judge sees. You can't write up guidelines for this. The judge has to look for this criterion, and that's the way it's going to work. The Kesef Mishnah, writing on the Rambam, wants to know, where did the Rambam get this idea from? Because this does not show up at all in the Gemara. Where did the Rambam get the idea of Nechpaz? And he traced it to the Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, a great rabbi in Morocco in the 10th century, 10th into the 11th. He was actually the mentor of the Rambam's father. If you think of Rambam, Maimonides in English, so Maimonides, he's the son of Maimon, so Maimon's mentor was the Rif, Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi. That seems to be the source for the statement by Maimonides. The Sma, Rabbi Yoshua Falk, gives us a definition of this. if you flip the page to source number 13, actually, I'm going even further, I'm sorry. I'm skipping it to number 13 is correct. Those who are confused and hasty in their minds, who are especially foolish. He's commenting on words that appear in the Code of Jewish Law. And he says, it appears that the explanation of all of these is that these are people who are not patient in their affairs. They do everything hastily. They don't understand to the end of the matter, and to the goal of the act, to the end that's anticipated. So he says, Mishumachi zeh gam kein b'shem shigaon ushtus yechashev. Therefore, these will also be considered foolishness and like the irrational person. If they are hasty, they don't have a healthy decision-making process. This is brought by Rabbi Shmuel de Medina in a responsum in source number 14. He talks about someone who has a powerful fever. And he says, that person counts. That person does not have a rational process anymore because their mind is gripped by the fever. They're not able to think straight. And again, this is a subjective judgment. So we started out by asking the question of whether we ever recognize a need for consent at all. And we said that yes, certainly where the treatment is itself questionable, or where the treatment is not going to save the person's life, you're maybe treating some local issue, that yes, consent is going to be required. We then asked, well, what defines incapacity to give consent? We compared it to the secular standard a little bit. And the answer is the person has to be rational, the person has to understand, and the person has to have a good decision-making process. So to give illustrations of where this might come up clinically, the peti would be a patient who doesn't understand due to intellectual deficiency and therefore declines treatment. The treatment makes perfect sense. If only the patient understood it, the patient would say, yes, please do that. The doctor says, well, you know what, this patient doesn't really get it, and therefore they're making the wrong decision. What do you do then? We get to next. The case of a nechpa, someone who is hasty. So the potential case, and I say it's potential, so you have to come back to it. I gave this form of this shir up at the bayit, and someone there challenged this case. The woman who when she goes into labor says, "I don't want an epidural," but then changes her mind during labor. So the argument could be made that now she's making a hasty decision. She is nechbaz because of the pain that she's in, and therefore she doesn't have the capacity to request the epidural. The argument from one participant was that just the opposite. At this point, her mind is clear. So we have to come back to that a little bit later. But that's a case. The feverish patient. The patient who's under stress because the patient is not able to cope with the diagnosis. Right? These may be cases of nechbaz. What if you have a patient who's undergoing severe depression, or even without the severity, just moderate depression? Maybe at that point they become hasty in their decision-making process. They write off ideas because of their condition. The Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, writing in the 14th century, and it's brought by his son, the Tur, talk about a man who displayed irrational anger at times, and whether that person might indeed qualify as a shota. So the process for diagnosis, it seems, is for comprehension and for haste, it's relatively logical. What are you going to do for irrationality? How do you diagnose irrationality? In other words, you can tell when you look at somebody and when you discuss things with them, you can tell whether they're understanding. You can tell whether someone is working their way through a thought process. Have a conversation with them. Ask them, so how did you come to that decision? But how do you diagnose irrationality? So the Talmud gives us a standard in source 15. It talks about someone who is nishtatek, who becomes mute, and we don't know what's going on in his head. V'amrulo nichtov get liishtacha. People asked him, should we write a get for your wife? V'hirchin barosho. And he nods his head. So how do we know what he means when he's nodding? Bodkin oso shlosha pa'amim. You examine him three times. Im amar alav lav. V'al hein hein. If to questions that he should answer no, he nods his head no. To questions for which he should answer yes, he nods his head yes. Then you would in fact write the get and deliver it to his wife. That's the standard. Some suggest that it's more than that. You have to look for physical manifestations of irrationality. So take a look, please, at source number 16, Rabbi Avraham Tzvi Hirsch Eisenstadt, in the anthology of responsa called Pitchei Tshuva, writes, the Gam Kasav, he's quoting an authority, V'gam kasav sham de'af ledas harambam desvirule dehani simane shot elav davka. Even within the view of Maimonides, who says that the signs that we gave in the Talmud for who is a shota are not specific, it's not just those, but any signs count. Haynu b'sha'ose eze masa shtus biyadayim. That's where he does something actively. Physically, aval imu rak medaber devarim shel shtus eino nechshav shote. But where he only speaks in a way that sounds irrational, that's not good enough. That doesn't qualify as being incapacitated due to irrationality. It is not clear to me why this is so. Why is it that speech that's irrational is not sufficient? I don't understand why we would say that. That requires more research. But that's his statement. In practice, we go with the Chasam Sofer statement that we read before, which is, it's up to the physician on the scene to do the evaluation as best he or she can and say, this patient has or has not demonstrated, number one, rationality, number two, comprehension, and number three, a patient thought process. Those are the three elements to this. So we've addressed when consent is needed. We've addressed incapacity. The third question we're going to have to get to is who speaks for an incapacitated patient and by what standard do they speak? How are they supposed to make the decisions on behalf of the patient? It is already 50 minutes in, 5-0. So I'm going to go to the third part. I'm going to remain afterwards until Sandy comes along and kicks me out to answer questions. So if you have questions on section two, please hold them until the end. I just want to make sure that people are able to go home when it's still safe. So the third part: who speaks for an incapacitated patient? We have to address: may the doctor act on the patient's behalf? Does a parent have the ability to function as a guardian for a child who is a minor or for a child who is an adult? By what principles does the party make the assessment? So remember that we already ruled out life and death cases in the beginning. Because we said that in life and death cases, where the physician has a clearly indicated way to save the patient's life and to cure the illness, ruling out the amputation case we talked about, and it doesn't involve great pain or gross invasion of the body, the physician doesn't listen to the patient. The patient can refuse, the physician does it anyway, within the eyes of Jewish law. Others may stand in place of the incapacitated patient in other cases. The secular standard is essentially the healthcare proxy. I don't know the official technical terms that are used here, but the power of attorney is another term for it. You assign somebody and say, that person is able to act. In the eyes of Jewish law, one may do the same. One appoints what's called a shaliach, an agent. And that agent's job is to carry out his will. And that, even if that person is not qualified by the Torah to serve as a witness or a judge, it doesn't matter who this person is. You can appoint whoever you like. Apotropos is court appointed. Shaliach is my own agent who I appointed. Thank you. Parents automatically make decisions on behalf of their minor children. This is a general principle, that parents are automatically considered to be shlichim, to be emissaries of their children, to handle their matters. So you have to treat a minor child. The child is not able to understand, is not of age even to have a rational thought process. The parent is going to be the one who's going to take care of the decision-making for the minor with a major qualification. Every few years you hear about a case where because of the parents' religious beliefs, the child is refused, the parents refuse treatment for the child. So Rav David Tzvi Hoffman addressed this in Germany in the 19th century. Take a look at source 17, please. He says, Kaven Deshari Lasos, if you look in the Hebrew, operation, kazoo, since the operation itself is a permitted operation. There's nothing in Jewish law to say that one should not go forward with it. Im kein bevadai das aviv ve'imo lo male v'lo morid. Then the view of the parents is irrelevant. Literally does not bring up, does not bring down. As I translated here, neither helps nor hinders. D'yesh chiyuv al harofe l'rapos, because the doctor is obligated to heal. V'monei atzmo hareza shofech damim. If the doctor refuses, then he's committing murder. We have not found anywhere in the Torah that parents have permission to endanger the lives of their child. Just pretend you didn't read the end of this week's parsha. They're not allowed to keep the doctor from healing the child. Zehu hadin Torah. V'dina demachusa eni yodeya ba'ofenze. He says, that's what I know about the Torah's law. I can't answer for what the government's law is, but I'll tell you that from the viewpoint of the Torah, if this is to heal the patient, then the parents are not entitled to refuse. Yes? 2A? So that's where I want to go. The next question is, what about the adult? So take a look, please, at source number 18. It's a different area of law. It's financial law, but I believe it does translate here as well. The Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in Poland in the beginning of the 16th century, says, Mishemina apotropos lebanav hagedolim. If somebody appoints an apotropos, appoints a guardian for his children who are adults. So I said before, apotropos is court appointed. I'm actually wondering now whether that's always true. It could be that the difference between apotropos and shaliach is simply that apotropos is really limited to guardianship, whereas shaliach is a term we use for all sorts of different acts of agency. Just because here it isn't necessarily where a court was convened. That's why I say it. So if someone appoints a guardian for his adult children, Yecholim lomar ein anu tzrichin apotropos. They're entitled to say, we don't need guardians. Unless there's a separate issue where the parent is dying and the parent gives some order and now the children have a requirement to obey the dying wishes of the parent. That's a separate discussion. But as a general rule, the parents are entitled to set up a guardian and then certainly to function themselves as guardians unless the children protest. If the children are themselves irrational, under any of the capacity of the standard of incapacity we gave, then the children are no longer able to protest. So in other words, it's within the parents' right to speak for adult children as well, unless those children, when they have capacity, refuse that agency.
What age
That's actually a really good question. At what point is a child said to become an adult? So bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah does work for certain issues, but not for all issues. We talk about children who are even younger than that, who demonstrate understanding, that we say that their decisions financially are actually binding, potentially even before that. There's one standard for taking vows. So I'm not sure what the standard actually is here. I want to look into that and come back to the group with it. I don't know. That's a good question. But it seems that parents do have the ability in general, which no one else would have. In other words, this is a special right of parents to appoint a guardian. I couldn't go up to somebody and say, I'm now appointing a guardian and he's valid unless you refuse. That's nonsense. But parents have that ability for their children even when their children have reached adulthood. What about the physician? Does the physician have the ability to act on behalf of the patient? Under the secular standard, physicians and healthcare professionals may indeed be called upon to direct treatment. And I have a whole bunch of literature on this from the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Saskatchewan and the Canadian Medical Association Code of Ethics and so on. There are cases in which the physician is called upon to make the assessment and decide what to do. Now, we've already said that we require consent, in particular, where the physician does not trust the patient, where the patient does not trust the physician. The physician poskened and said, this is the treatment, and the patient said, I don't want your treatment. So now, what are we supposed to do? Well, if the patient's will is in fact void, then the physician has the right to act in the manner that he deems medically appropriate. The obstacle to following consensus is now gone. However, note the words of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Did I bring it here? No. In source number 20. I forgot that I had brought the Canadian Medical Association Code of Ethics on the sheet. But you can see that there. But in source number 20, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein said, certainly, where the doubts are not equal, the doubts between doing the operation, not doing the operation. For he would certainly die without the operation, and the concern for his state of mind is only a doubt. And it is even less of a doubt because the doctors have told him that he'll heal from the operation. They are certainly permitted, and it will be a great mitzvah, the act of saving his life, to act against his will, even by tying down his body. You could do it. However, obligating them to do this to an adult is uncertain, for even the view which says that one may not harm himself is referring to harm via action. Not so fast. There is a concept that people are entitled to refuse help. When we say a Jew is not allowed to harm himself, that refers to active harm. But what about if he says, I don't want to go to the doctor? Is he harming himself? Not in an active way. So Rav Moshe says, not so fast. That's not so clear cut. It's not telling a physician, do this against the will of the patient, tie him down and do this because he doesn't know what he's talking about, is a dicey thing to do. And Rav Moshe stops short of being quite comfortable with this idea, because fundamentally within halacha as well as secular law, this is assault. The only reason that we're even considering it is because the patient doesn't know better. Sorry? If it's a life and death situation, and you know that this is the treatment to do, and this is the treatment that's going to cure him, then yes. Right. No, that particular case, that's true. But yet he says maybe the patient has the right to do that. Maybe there is a concept of the patient being able to say, "I don't want to be helped." Is that he's not quite comfortable. Right, so this brings us to the next question. Not next question in terms of the shear, but sort of a next level question of what does a physician do when halacha says do this and secular law says don't? Which has come up in a variety of ways in various sessions. And the best answer that I've heard from physicians themselves is at a certain point you may need to say, I need to transfer you to another physician whose beliefs are consistent with this, and let that other physician be the one to treat you. That's not always an option. I know that that's not always an option. And that becomes a lot more dicey, and that's all I can really say without having a specific case at hand. But this is an issue not just for us, but it's discussed in the codes of ethics for physicians, where the physician's personal ethics clash with what the law is telling him to do. I don't know what the law says in the case of the blood transfusion. What does the law say where parents refuse a blood transfusion for their child on religious grounds? Sorry? You think that they do? Do you think they go ahead with the transfusion? That's not called jumping in anymore. That's sort of like tiptoeing. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And they did. Yeah, it comes up. You see them in the headlines every few years. So that's actually required, is that it go through the courts. That's interesting. Yes? Right, so where the patient poses a risk to others, you are required to treat, and the patient does not have a say. In cases of contagion, that's usually where it comes up, the patient does not have the right to protest. And that there's quite a bit of response to literature on it, and that's the... So then you get into relative questions, and what are your options? In other words, what if I don't treat him, but I sequester him? He's quarantined, so now nobody can become ill from him, and so on. And that's where it does get more complicated. But in terms of refusing treatment, we dealt with the case last year. I gave this up at the Bayit. I don't know if I also had it down here. We talked about issues of confidentiality. And I don't think I did the confidentiality one down here. But the question came up, where you have a physician who can see that the physician is treating somebody who has seizures, and he knows that the patient is driving. So even though there is normally a sense of confidentiality between doctor and patient, he's required not just by secular law, but by halacha, to make sure that this patient is not going to go behind the wheel. So you have cases like that. Yes? Really? Wow. Well, that was what was said back here also. He's saying that the doctor is supposed to refer the child to Children's Aid, and I guess they end up representing the child then at that point. Okay. So what standards do we use when speaking for an incapacitated patient? There's one approach that's known as the best interest standard. What do I think is going to help him most? And we have that concept within Judaism. Take a look, please, at source number 21, dealing with guardians who are appointed to take care of the estates of children. And I'm doing the English at this point just in the interest of time. We are told guardians are not allowed to sell fields and purchase slaves. Leave aside the discussion of slavery. It's a fun discussion, but not for right now. But guardians are not allowed to sell off fields that are owned by the people whose estate he's managing. They're not allowed to purchase slaves either, but they may sell slaves and purchase fields. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says they may not sell slaves and purchase fields either. Why? They may not work out well with him. Things may not work out. And the point out of this is not the fields and the slaves and all that. The point is, really, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's point, which we take very seriously, is they're not allowed to do things that are not objectively a zechut, a merit, on behalf of the person whose estate they're taking care of. The guardian is required to engage in activity which they can reasonably expect, and there's a fairly high threshold in this regard as far as reasonably, will not harm them. They are able to do things that are damaging for the kids right now if there's going to be a payoff from it. Fascinating case in source 22. Sage by the name of Rabba. Rabba required the orphans of the house of Bar Marion to give tzedakah. They had to give tzedakah. There was a local collection for some cause, and he said some of their assets have to go for this collection. Abaye, who's a student of Rabba, actually he was raised by Rabba, he himself, Abaye, was an orphan raised by Rabba, so maybe he has a hand in this. Abaye turns to him and says, wait a minute, didn't Rav Shmuel Bar Yehuda teach one may not decree tzedakah upon orphans even to redeem captives? One of the highest forms of charity is to redeem captives. Even then, you're not allowed to. You can't take their money. So Rabba replied, I'm doing it to increase their communal standing. They will have a certain stature in the community when they are known as people who assisted in whatever this immediate need was. They will be taken more seriously. They will be players, so to speak, in the community, and therefore it's good for them. So that's one idea, is we look at their best interest, and it's the job of whoever's making the decision to say, this is good for them in the end. That's one possibility. The other approach is what's called the substituted judgment standard, in which I don't say, what do I think is good for them, but what would they have decided? So, for example, if I know that this person is incapacitated, before he became incapacitated, expressed a certain wish, I happen to think that that's not in his best interest. But I know that was his wish. Substituted judgment means I follow what I know he expressed back then, all other things being equal, assuming nothing has changed drastically in the situation since that wish was expressed. And that's what drives the healthcare proxy concept. We have sources that accept substituted judgment. Take a look, please, at source number 23. Dealing with a case in which a man becomes a shote, and the court descends into his assets in order to feed his wife, support his wife and children, and then also the court will go into his assets for another reason, for some other purpose, it says. What does that mean? What's the other purpose? What is another matter? Rav Chisda said, jewelry, to buy jewelry for his wife. Rav Yosef said, for tzedakah. They can go into his assets for these purposes as well. Why? Source 24, Rabbi Yosef Karo explains, one could say that our master's reason for approving this, our master, he means Maimonides, who followed this line in the Talmud, was that we may assume that people want their assets to be used for tzedakah. It's a safe assumption. People want their assets to be used charitably. He would have wanted this. It's not about whether it's good for him or bad for him. But we know that that would have been his wish. Now, the truth of the matter is that there are sources that seem to render this somewhat questionable. There is a comment from Tosafot, writing in the 12th or 13th century on the Talmud, that you're not allowed to eat other people's food, even if you know that they would consent. Why is that? If you're telling me that there's such a concept as acting as you know they would have approved, why is that? So Rabbi Moshe Meiselman in Halacha or Refua says, Tosfot would agree in a situation where 100% of people would agree. That he's dealing with a case that's less certain. If there's something that everybody does, and I don't even know if 100% is exactly 100%, if everybody does a certain thing, or if someone made his will known, then we're good with that. That is considered to be sufficient. So, going back to the case, let's say, of the woman in labor, right? Let's say I think that the woman who is in labor, who now says, I changed my mind, I want the epidural. Let's pretend that we say she's considered nechbaz. She's considered to be hasty. Now she's not using a rational decision-making process. So then, what do we do? Well, best interest may say, give her the epidural because I think it's good for her not to be in pain. Substituted judgment may say, yeah, but her last expressed wish was not to have the epidural. She said she didn't want one at the time when she was not under strain. So that taking a different approach will lead you to a different conclusion. In practice, yeah. Why is it not rational?
It's very rational. I mean,
people rationally, remember, we distinguish between an irrational decision and a bad decision. It's reasonable, for example, it's reasonable for me to say, I believe the benefits of going through the experience in this way exceed what I'm going to lose by experiencing this pain. I'm not comfortable speaking about childbirth because, you know, it's an abstract concept. But it is legitimate for me to say I want to run a marathon. I know that it's going to damage my knees. I know that in the long run it's going to be bad for me in this way, that way, and the other way. But the benefits of running a marathon, whether it's my emotional satisfaction and my sense of self-confidence, or whether it's what the training will do for my discipline or for muscles or whatever it is, that to me exceeds, you know, whatever my pain is going to be in doing so. I'm entitled to make that decision.
So if somebody wants to climb Mount Everest and a storm is coming, and they want the experience of climbing Mount Everest, they should just be allowed to do it even if a storm is coming in avalanches. But that woman that...
So the question would be, let's evaluate the decision-making process. Did they understand the risks, so they're not a petty? Did they make a point A to point B to point C decision, so they, you know, they were rational, they didn't display irrationality in any particular matter? And was it, you know, thought out, or was it hasty? If they can answer those three, you know, if they can meet those three standards, then that's their decision. It may be a bad decision, but they met the standard for consent in that case. In practice, which approach do we use? So the secular standard, as I understand it, is to go with substituted judgment to the extent that that is possible. If you go back to Source 19, the Canadian Medical Association Code of Ethics, ascertain wherever possible and recognize your patient's wishes about the initiation, continuation, or cessation of life-sustaining treatment. Respect the intentions of an incompetent patient as they were expressed, valid advance directive, proxy designation, before the patient became incompetent. When the intentions of an incompetent patient are unknown, and when no formal mechanism for making treatment decisions is in place, there is no proxy, render such treatment as you believe to be in accordance with the patient's values, or if these are unknown, the patient's best interests. First, substitute a judgment, and only if you can't, then you're going to say, all right, I'm going to go with best interest. There are those who reject this in the secular literature. There was a study done in 1991 that found only 68% accuracy when they tried to decide based on what the patient would have wanted. In other words, they asked the patient afterwards, says, no, that's not at all what I would have wanted. 68% accuracy. Also, people change their minds. They may have made a statement 10 years ago, but it isn't where they are today. Or people want input into decisions. They don't want to make the decision, but they don't want to make the decisions themselves. So that they may have expressed their thoughts without thinking that that was going to be what actually is carried out, without taking into consideration what the doctor says. Here's the doctor saying, I want to do what the patient wanted. But if the patient could speak, the patient would say, I want to know your opinion. I don't want to be the one to decide this myself in a vacuum. So there are those who oppose it and say, no, we should have a third standard. The standard should be community norms. Let there be you know, some standard in the community, not whatever the patient said 10 years ago. In terms of halacha, modern authorities seem to go with substituted judgment, which is the secular standard of trying to figure out what the patient wanted. Rav Eliyahu Bakshi Doron, writing in Binyan Av, rules that we assess what a patient would have wanted in certain cases. If you take a look on your sheet at source 25, the last of our sources, Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote the following. In most cases, he says, he's dealing with a case in which, well, let's see it. In most cases, the patient has relatives, father, mother, brothers, the like, who are involved in his treatment. And there you consult them, for it is legally their responsibility to a greater extent. They're supposed to be taking care of the patient. They are the ones you will consult. If the patient is a baby or an adult who cannot decide, his parents and the whole family may decide. This permission stems from the fact that most patients depend upon their parents' opinion and even upon the family, like brothers and sisters and children, who want what is best for the patient and his family. So in other words, because the patient would have turned to them, we will turn to them. It's effectively saying they are the ones who are best suited to know what the patient wanted, because the patient would have gone with them to be the one. Just to finish the line, when there are no relatives, it is certainly better to depend upon the view of the local courts, the local Beit Din. Yes? Right. Correct. Then it gets messy. I keep thinking of the Terry Schiavo case, right? Where, leaving aside the medical details there, parents are saying one thing, spouse is saying another. Now what? The right? What if you have reason to think that the spouse is not considering, or the parent, or the child is not considering the best interests of the patient, or what the patient actually would have requested? You're right. Those become much more complex. It's interesting that Moshe Feinstein, in this responsum, did not mention spouse. Right? I don't think he actually mentioned spouse in there. He mentioned all sorts of relatives. I wonder about that, and what would happen, in fact, in a case of parent versus spouse. I want to do a little research on it and come back to you, because I think it's a fascinating question. Yes? So that case depends a lot more on what the medical treatment involved is. In other words, if we're talking about euthanizing, we may be talking about something, and likely are talking about something, which we wouldn't sanction even if the patient was perfectly sane and able to speak and a mature adult. So if you're dealing with denial of treatment, then, I mean, leaving aside the specifics of that you know, real-life case, The denial of treatment will go back to Rav David Zvi Hoffman, right? Where Rav David Zvi Hoffman said, parents are not entitled to refuse medical treatment that's meant to save the child's life. However, if we're in a situation in which halacha would say you're not required to give that treatment, that may take us... So that may be, indeed, that case may be handled differently. I could definitely see the argument to handle that differently. Yes?
I agree with everything you said. Okay. The epidural thing, pain, and you think that when someone makes a decision that they're going to tough it out and they're not going to get anything for pain, that they're irrational when they suddenly realize how severe the pain is? Because
right.
That's what happens.
So
then they suddenly realize they made a bad decision initially and that they had no idea how painful it was, and they finally come to their senses. So,
right. So I did mention when I first brought the case in that you could make the argument that that's actually now is when they have the clarity. That's certainly true. So no, I was only using that as a potential illustration, but not to say that this would be the ruling in this case, because you're right, there is definitely that possible argument. I just want to make sure to mention before people go, again, make sure you have signed in, because in order to be able to, number one, send you the evaluation, which we require, and number two, in order for those who are getting credit to be able to get credit, we need to have your name and email address. Further questions? I'm going to stay here. So if you have further questions you want to ask me about, that's fine. Thank you very much. I'm impressed that so many people came out in the storm. Please drive safely on your way.